Who hath woe? Who hath sorrow? Who hath contentions? Who hath babblings? Who hath wounds without cause? Who hath redness of eyes? They that tarry long at the wine, they that go to seek mixed wine, look not thou upon the wine when it is red, when it giveth his collar in the cup, when it moveth against or itself aright. At the last it biteth like a serpent and stingeth like an adder. Thine eyes shall behold strange women. Thine heart shall utter perverse things. Yea, thou shalt be as he that lieth down in the midst of the sea, or as he that lieth upon the top of a mast. They have stricken me, shalt thou say, and I was not sick. They have beaten me, and I felt it not. When shall I awake? I will seek it yet again. Proverbs 23, verses 29 through 35. This description of alcohol and the abuse of alcohol is vivid for anyone who has known its bite and has felt its sting. It is my desire that no one goes away without fully realizing the poison of alcoholic beverages. It is man's most abused drug. It has caused or contributed to broken homes, accidents of every kind, disease both physical and mental, poverty, crime, and a host of other sins. Its use is not social in any way, but in every way antisocial. Its defense by sweet-talking, soft-peddling, so-called preachers is religiously hypocritical, morally irresponsible, and socially despicable. Its use has victimized the unborn, children, teenagers, the young, the middle-aged, and the old. It has victimized business people and laborers, country folks and city folks, the rich and the poor. There is no one who has not been victimized in some way by its bite and by its sting. Yet, there are those who want to justify its use. So they twist the scriptures to justify themselves and others, and it's unto their own destruction, as we read clearly in 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 16. These are the unlearned, these are the unstable, who rest, who twist the scriptures to their own destruction. And so such scriptures as John, the second chapter, and the marriage feast of Canaan, and 1 Timothy 3, verse 8, and the qualifications of deacons, and 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 23, the injunction given by Paul to Timothy, the young evangelist, and of course, with the Lord's Supper, even Matthew 26. They're all twisted to justify the so-called social drink. Before we begin an examination of the text that has been assigned, let us establish some principles as groundwork. The first principle I want to establish is simply, let us never be guilty of giving first century words 20th century definitions. The 20th century definition of wine is, and I quote, "the fermented juice of fresh grapes used as a beverage," the Webster's Collegiate Dictionary. While the first century word, oinos in the Greek, which is translated wine, is generic and can refer to alcoholic wine that causes intoxication or simply grape juice that is not fermented. The context in which that word is used, that word is found, will determine whether it refers to alcoholic wine or non-alcoholic wine. Now, I believe that everyone here would agree that the word wine refers to alcoholic wine. And so it's up to me then to prove that it can refer to then, in some places in the Bible, as non-alcoholic wine. And so I've chosen three examples of that. Joel chapter 1 and verse 10 is the first example. There Joel writes, "The field is wasted, the land mourneth, for the corn is wasted, the new wine is dried up, the oil languisheth." This refers to grapes that have dried up in the field, and he calls it simply the wine is dried up. Those grapes that have dried up in the field certainly could not be intoxicating. Another passage in which the word wine is used with reference to non-alcoholic wine is Isaiah 65 and verse 8. There Isaiah said, "Thus saith the Lord, as the new wine is found in the cluster." Now he's talking about clusters of grapes. And he's talking about wine in those clusters of grapes. Obviously, the wine that's found in the cluster of grapes could not be alcoholic wine, could only be non-alcoholic wine, could only be the juice of the grapes. In Jeremiah, the 48th chapter, and in verse 33, again, we find a third example. Notice what Jeremiah writes. "And joy and gladness is taken from the plentiful field and from the land of Moab, and I have caused wine to fail from the winepress. None shall tread with shouting. Their shouting shall be no shouting." Now the wine is talking about here is wine that is failed from the press. That is, that fresh grape juice that would come out of the wine press has simply failed. Brethren, that could not be alcoholic wine. The only kind of wine that you can get out of a fresh grapes from a wine press is grape juice. By the way, brethren, we also use the term wine press. Now, I wonder about that particular word. Does it not also tell us that the word wine can be used of non-alcoholic wine, grape juice, as well as the other? I believe so. A second principle that we ought to consider in thinking about this particular topic is that there are preservation methods in the first century. One of the objections that I've heard over the years is that all those old-fashioned people, they didn't have any ways to preserve grape juice. I've heard the same argument used about instrumental music, but at any rate, that's another story altogether. But the fact is, they did have preservation methods. In the book, and I would suggest obtaining this book, Bible Wines by William Patton of the Star Bible Publication, discussed in that book four methods of preservations of grape juice in the first century. One such method was to make a jar completely airtight, that it would completely be excluded from air. Interestingly, R.C. Foster in his book, Studies in the Life of Christ, makes mention of this, and he says, and I quote, "A Greek wine ship of the 2nd century B.C. found by divers off the southern coast of France several years ago contained a great number of wine flasks that had been sealed so tight that after more than 2,000 years, the seawater had not seeped into it." Brethren, that illustrates for us, they did have at least one way, and of course, Patton makes mention of four ways, to seal grape juice in order for it not to turn into wine. A third principle that we ought to consider is the fact that the effects of wine, or maybe I should broaden that out, the effects of alcohol begin with the first drink. No one who has ever abstained from alcoholic beverage became a drunkard. That's the point I'm trying to make here. Drunkards begin by drinking the first drink. I remember a few years ago, I was laboring in the church at Eureka, Kansas, and while I was laboring there, it was my opportunity to become and a registered EMT, an emergency medical technician, worked with the Greenwood County Ambulance Association. We were called one morning to a house. I remember going out and getting into my car and speeding down the road and getting into the ambulance at the ambulance bar and speeding across town to pull into this house. I was the attendant on that particular occasion. And I got out of the ambulance, walked down around to the back to pull out the gurney. And one of the men that had already gone into the house came out and said, "Strip the cot." And I looked at him real funny. And I must have kind of gave him an odd gaze because he said, again, "Strip the cot." Well, it wasn't a normal practice that we had, was to strip the cot of its cloth over the top of it, of its sheet. But I went on and did it, and he grabbed one end of the gurney, and I grabbed the other end, and we went into the house. And just as we came through the door, and I remember just as almost like it was yesterday, and this is almost 20 years ago, as we came into the door, there was a chair right there, and there was a dead man sitting in that chair. And we turned off to the left, and right at the front wall there, right below the picture window, there was a man laying there on the divan. The night before, him and his buddy had gotten drunk. The man that was sitting in the chair, the dead man, had choked on his own vomit. The other man was so drunk that he could not get up to go to the phone. The man's name that was alive was Lazarus. I remember very well, I suppose because of his association, the name's association with the Bible's characters. Unlike the Bible character, though, in many ways. And Lazarus, we picked him up off of the divan. He had been laying there in his own urine and his own waste products. And we picked him up and put him on the cot and headed out the door. Take him up to the hospital for him to dry out. Lazarus said, "Just take me to the river and throw me in." And I believe to this day the man that I was with, if he could have gotten away with it, would have done that very thing. But here's the point. Do you think Lazarus would have become an old drunk without the first drink? He started the path that he led because of that first drink. Habakkuk 2 and verse 15. "Woe unto him that giveth his neighbor drink, that putteth thy bottle to him and maketh him drunken also, that thou mayest look on their nakedness." A fourth principle that we should consider is that drunkenness is progressive, and that drunkenness is a matter of degrees. In other words, what I'm saying is that everyone who drinks is drunk to some degree. The effects of alcohol begins with the first drink, brethren. Let's get it in our minds here. Now, I realize that someone who drinks that first drink is not staggering drunk, but that doesn't any less mean that he's not drunk. The automobile societies, the insurance agencies, and others of this world have for many years tested various ones with alcohol to see what reactions that they have to it. I remember clear back when I was in high school, that's more than 20 or nearly 25 years ago, they were talking to us about this very thing. You see, the effects of alcohol begin with that first drink. We then are some ways affected by that. The word matrusko in the Greek, which is the Greek form of the word drunkenness, means to grow drunk. And it really, in the word itself, shows this progressiveness. It shows that the process of the state expressed. And so what I'm saying is this, and though one may not be, like I say, staggering drunk, yet they are still drunk to some degree. When a person drinks one drink, he's one drink drunk. When a person drinks two drinks, he's two drinks drunk. When a person drinks three drinks, he's three drinks drunk, is just simply a matter of degrees. And a final principle is that one characteristic of alcoholic beverage is that it is deceptive. I've said for many years, you can't believe a single word the devil says because he's the father of lies. And I don't believe we can believe a single word that wine says, that is alcoholic wine, or that booze say, because it is deceptive. In Proverbs 20 and verse 1, Solomon said, "Wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, and he that is deceived, or whosoever is deceived thereby, is not wise." Now notice he says, "Whosoever is deceived thereby is not wise." That shows that alcoholic beverage is deceptive. Responsible drinking, social drinking, and moderate drinking are misnomers. They're deceptive terms. For drinking is in every way irresponsible. It is antisocial because it destroys the very foundation of society, and there's nothing moderate about it. It is deceptive, for it parades about, showing itself sometimes as something that is good, while in reality, in actuality, it is evil, causing anguish and pain and misery and sorrow and death, and the list goes on and on. Now let's deal with our text and the questions that have been assigned. The first question is, did the Lord make an intoxicating beverage? John chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. Now let's first begin by this, and I believe all of those things that we've said about alcoholic beverages, that is, those principles, those five principles, can be applied to this particular text. But let's refer back to the principle already stated. The word translated wine in this and all texts of the New Testament can refer to alcoholic wine or non-alcoholic wine. Let us never be guilty then of interpretations based solely upon 20th century definitions. The immediate context of the use of the word wine in this text will help us to understand whether it refers to alcoholic wine or non-alcoholic wine. Those who believe that Jesus made alcoholic wine must first prove that which they simply cannot do. However, they argue that the good wine is intoxicating wine, but the textual evidence clearly indicates just the opposite. The guests at the marriage feast of Canaan were able to discern the quality between what the Lord had made and that which had already been drunk. People who have well drunk, as the King James says, verse 10, or who have drunk freely, as the American Standard says in the same verse, could not have such keen discernments. I remember when I was a senior in high school, and like most kids, they have to experience some of this kind of stuff to find the foolishness of it. And we had, I don't like to admit it, but we had experience that, or I had. And I had been introduced to the church, and I remember one time going over to a party. And I'd already been introduced to the church and knew that if a man became a Christian, that he had to put away those kind of things, and was convicted of it. I hadn't been convicted of gambling yet, but I was convicted about that. And I went over to this penny poker game that a bunch of us boys were going to have. And I brought in my soda pop, and they brought in their beer and other kind of booze. And I remember when we started gambling, they were the winners. I was losing everything. But you know, as they drank and drank and drank, I began to win and win and win. The point I'm making here is this. Someone who drinks do not have keen discernments. They then become sluggish of mind, and they then begin to do foolish things. Well, those at the marriage feast of Canaan simply could not have discerned between the two. Now let's look at verse 10, he says. And it saith unto him, every man at the beginning doth set forth good wine, and when men have drunk, or well drunk, then that which is worse, but thou hast kept the good wine until now. The point is then, the good wine could not have been intoxicating wine, because if they had drunk the good wine, intoxicating wine, as they say, then they could not have the discernment to tell the difference of that wine at the end. Further notice that if the Lord had turned water into alcoholic beverage, he had then turned and made a tremendous quantity of booze. You remember that there were six water pots of stone, and each of those water pots contained two or three firkins apiece. That's verse 6. Now, a firkin is approximately 9 gallons. Actually, it's between 8 to 10 gallons, which totals 106 gallons of wine to about 162 gallons of wine. Now, if the Lord had turned it into alcoholic wine, it is far more than enough that just the most casual drinker would have been drunk. As a perfect man, Jesus could not have turned water into wine, alcoholic wine, and offer such to others. If Jesus had supplied alcoholic, intoxicating wine to the wedding guest of Canaan, then he contributed to their intoxication. And since intoxication is sinful, then Jesus must have sinned. Think about it for a moment. You can't have it any other way. This would be opposed to his very own teaching. Remember back over in Luke, the 17th chapter, verses 1 and 2. He said to the disciples, "It is impossible but that offenses will come. But woe unto him through whom they come. It were better for him that a millstone were hung about his neck and he cast into the sea than that he should offend one of these little ones." Now you think about the very thing that we're talking about here. Not only would we find that Jesus could not be a perfect man because he sinned by offering intoxicating drink, but he would be hypocritical as well. He offering intoxicating drink would be offense to some men. Surely we would recognize that some of those men might be like that fellow that I knew, Lazarus, who took that first drink and then later on became an old drunk because of that first drink. He then would be an offense to others. Hypocritical. He would be one that, as Jesus said, the millstone ought to be hung about his neck and thrown and cast into the sea. But I'm reminded of the words of Habakkuk again. Habakkuk 2 and verse 15. "Woe unto him that giveth his neighbor drink, and putteth thy bottle to him, and maketh him drunken also." That woe would have been against Jesus if he had drunk and turned, or if he had turned that water into alcoholic wine. Furthermore, if we are interested in and intent on twisting the scriptures to justify alcoholic beverage, then consider the wines of the first century Palestine. The alcoholic wine of first century Palestine was unlike our fiery, fortified, and intensified wines of today. Their wines were diluted with water, one part wine to two to three parts water, while ours are fortified with alcohols. Now notice what I'm saying here. Their wines were diluted. Ours is fortified with alcohol. Well, the point that I'm making by that is that no person, can appeal to this circumstance in favor of drinking alcoholic beverages unless he can prove that the wines our Lord made is exactly like the wines which he purposes to drink. Now what I'm saying is this. Even if you believe that the alcohol or the wine that the Lord made was alcoholic, the best you could do would be to use that to show that you could drink the very same thing that he drank. You couldn't use it to justify yourself to drink bourbon or whiskey or vodka or beer or any other such thing. The best you could do would be to prove that you could only drink what he drank. Of course, I think I clearly showed that it was not alcoholic wine anyway. The second question then is, is moderate use of alcohol condoned? 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 8, and chapter 5, and verse 23. In 1 Timothy 3, verse 8, is concerning the qualifications of deacons, and it says, "Likewise must the deacons be grave, not double-tongued, not given to much wine, not greedy of filthy lucre." We'll begin with their argument. They begin their argument generally with a few verses back, five verses back, verse 3, with the qualifications of elders. Those who would argue that moderate drinking of alcoholic beverage say, and I quote, "The word means disposed or addicted to wine. And since one may drink in moderation without being addicted to it, one is at liberty to drink." Concerning the deacon's qualification, they continue, the addition of the word "much" implies that a moderate consumption of wine, alcoholic beverage, is all right. Now, in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 3, the qualification of an elder is simply not given to wine. This literally means, and not at, by, near, or with wine. That's what it literally means. The person who is in the habit of drinking, that is drinking wine, or associates with those who gratify themselves with it, or participates in revelry caused by it, is not qualified to serve in the leadership of the church. The qualification means that not only are they not to consume it, they are not to even be around it. But someone says, well, yeah, that's true. But what about the deacons? It says, much wine, and the emphasis is upon much. And in my notes, I put it in bold print, much wine. Well, brethren, let's look at the text. He says, likewise. Now, what is he talking about there? What he's talking about is like the elders. Likewise, in the same way, after the same manner, in like manner. Thus, like deacons, or like elders, rather, deacons are not to be near wine. Now, let's apply their reasoning with this word much in the same way in other passages as they do. Now, the next qualification of a deacon is not greedy of guilt, or of, not greedy of guilty lucre, guilty of filthy lucre. With the same logic and reasoning, it would mean that a deacon could be guilty of filthy lucre as long as he didn't get greedy. Think about it for a moment. It's the same exact reasoning. Filthy lucre, you remember, is immoral or illegal gain. So in other words, as long as this deacon then didn't get greedy, he could sell drugs. I mean, that's filthy lucre. He could have a prostitution ring. And the list goes on and on and on. Well, we wouldn't apply it in such a way. How silly can we be? Or let's apply it to an injunction given by Solomon in Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 17. And I chose this particular injunction because of the word much in it. There Solomon wrote, be not over much wicked. So if we apply their reason then, and reasoning power and logic, to this particular passage, it would be all right to be, well, over wicked, just not over much wicked. Well, how foolish can we be? Brethren, we would not apply passages as such. So let us not then apply 1 Timothy 3 and verse 8 to justify moderate consumption of alcohol. The passage simply means not turning one's mind to, not attending to drink, that is wine. In 1 Timothy 5 and verse 23, we find our next passage, which Paul says to Timothy, drink no longer water, but use a little wine for thy stomach's sake and thine often infirmities. Now, drink no longer water simply means be no longer a drinker of water. This does not mean that Timothy was to quit altogether drinking water. Rather, he is to drink wine as well. And so Paul says, use a little wine. Now, it's amazing to me. I've met a few drunks in my life besides old Lazarus, and every one of them seems to know this passage. Every one of them have memorized this verse to justify himself in his evil deeds. Remember, wine can mean alcoholic wine or grape juice. And so the question is, which is this text referring to? Well, some believe that Paul is told Timothy to use a little alcoholic wine to purify or sanitize the drinking water. My sons and I have on many occasions gone out to Colorado to do a little backpacking. And I have a little bottle of iodine tablets at home, and we get water out of a stream and put a tablet in there and sanitize the water that way. I wouldn't call it purify because the stuff is rather putrid, but at any rate, that's what we do with it. It makes the water taste terrible. But at any rate, it does sanitize the water and makes it consumable at least. Others believe that the instruction given to Timothy was to use some non-alcoholic wine, that is grape juice, to settle his stomach. Now, this is the point I'm really trying to make. And that is, either purpose, either way you want to interpret it, really matters not to me. But either way, the use was for medicinal purposes. There is no other purpose for Paul's instruction, any justification for using fermented wine and any other alcoholic beverage for any other purpose than medicinal is simply not found in this passage. I think, though, we can prove and show that in the context that he's really not talking about alcoholic wine. It is amazing to me. For years I've been taught that this is simply the purifying or the sanitizing of the drinking water. And as I began then to read and to study 1 Timothy chapter 5, looking at that passage, if you think about it as being sanitizing drinking water, how does it fit with the rest of the text? How does it fit with verse 22 and verse 24? How does it fit with the chapter and so forth? Well, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. It's almost as if it's a parenthetical statement if you think about it that way. But here's the point I think that Paul is making in this passage. There are many heartfelt, heart-riching situations that an evangelist is involved in, and in which we do not always know the heart of our co-workers, nor the outcome. Those situations would make anyone's stomach a little upset. Sometimes I take Rolaids, and I believe that's what he's talking about here. In other words, Paul is saying, don't just drink water. Use a little grape juice to settle your stomach and the other illnesses that would be obviously related to that. Finally then, Matthew the 26th chapter, verses 18 to 29. And the question is, was the beverage used in the institution of the Lord's Supper alcoholic? During the institution of the Lord's Supper, our Lord authorized two elements: the unleavened bread and the fruit of the vine, representing the Lord's body and blood. The connection between the Passover of the Old Testament and the Lord's Supper is unquestioned. We understand that the Passover was a type of the sacrifice of Christ, and that Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us, 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 7. And we understand that the Lord's Supper was instituted in the upper room after our Lord and His apostles ate the Passover. The connection is even to the extent that some of the same elements were used. During the Passover, all leaven was forbidden, even to the extent that it was not even allowed in the house for 7 days, lest they be cut off from Israel, like Exodus 12 and verse 15. Fermentation is a type of leaven. And the word leaven and the word ferment comes from the same original words and means basically the same thing. And thus, the wine of the Jewish Passover, as commanded by God — now notice what I said, as commanded by God, not by what they practice today, because they don't practice this — and thus the wine of the Jewish Passover, as commanded by God, was simply grape juice. Leaven is often a symbol of sin and corruption. You remember our Lord talked about the leaven of the Pharisees? What was He talking about? He's talking about the corruption that the Pharisees taught. And you remember 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 6 through 8? You can't come up here yet. Here comes the beast. I've been wanting to say that for 8 years. You remember chapter 5 and verse 6 through 8 of 1 Corinthians? He says, "Your glorying is not good. Know ye not that a little leaven leaveneth the whole lump? Purge out therefore the old leaven, that ye may be a new lump, as ye are unleavened. For even Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us. Therefore let us keep the feast with the old leaven, neither with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth." Christ, in contrast to leavened bread, has no sin. He is the priest, the high priest, that is touched with the feelings of our infirmities and is in all points tempted like we are, yet without sin. Further notice this prophecy and its fulfillment. In Psalm 16 and verse 10, the psalmist says, "For thou wilt not leave my soul in hell, neither wilt thou suffer thy Holy One to see corruption." In Acts 2 and verse 31, on the day of Pentecost, Peter said, here's the fulfillment. He's seen this before, spake of the resurrection of Christ, that his soul was not left in hell, neither did his flesh see corruption. Thus, just as unleavened, or just as leavened bread could not properly symbolize our Lord's body, leavened, fermented, corrupted grape juice, alcoholic wine, could not properly symbolize our Lord's blood. Also notice the term fruit of the vine. Rather than using the generic term wine, oinos, our Lord chose the term fruit of the vine. The word fruit is not the ordinary produce. It's not just any produce, but is the offspring, literally, of the vine. And it is that which the vine begets. The fruit of the vine, the juice of the grape, is that fruit of the vine. Not alcoholic, for that's a byproduct of it. If wine was acceptable, whether fermented or not fermented, then our Lord could have used and would have used that generic term, oinos, rather than the specific term, fruit of the vine. God has always demanded our first fruits. Alcoholic wine is not a natural fruit, and it's certainly not a first fruit. Grape juice is the first fruit. There is much more that can be said on the subject of alcohol, and many other scriptures that have been twisted to justify its use. However, the Bible is quite clear on the use of alcohol. It is strictly forbidden. At the very least, it is questionable practice, and we ought to stay away from its evil bite and viperous sting. It is beyond my reasoning power to understand how people who claim to be spiritually minded and morally upright will justify its use. Many innocent people have broken hearts because of alcohol. Many innocent people have broken homes because of alcohol. Many innocent people have wasted resources because of alcohol. And many innocent people have wasted abilities because of alcohol. Innocent people have fallen victim to every crime imaginable because of alcohol. The results of alcohol are staggering, pun intended. Blood has filled our streets because of this vile beverage. Graves have filled our hills and vales because of this evil drink. Reproach has filled our nation because of that wicked intoxicant. Corruption has filled our society because of this corrupted liquor. Shame and disgrace has filled our homes because of this malicious booze. Dear brethren, rather than justifying its use by twisting the scriptures, let us stand diametrically opposed to it. Wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, and whosoever is deceived thereby is not wise.